Hi, I'm Chris Wigley, CEO of Genomics England. I've spent my career at the intersection of technology, ethics, and human stories. Now I lead the amazing team here at Genomics England. We're trying to bring the benefits of genomic medicine to everyone, and that involves accelerating genomic research and also working with the NHS to bring genomics into the heart of healthcare. Genomics is a word that can trigger really strong responses, hope, fear, anger, and there's a lot of information out there, but it's not all accessible to non-experts. And there are some myths out there. So we want to talk more about this word, the G word, genomics. That's what this podcast is about. Welcome to the G word.
So it's my pleasure to be joined on the G word today by Dr. Saskia Sanderson. She is a behavioral scientist and an advocate of getting ordinary people to the table to discuss the kinds of issues that we love at the G word. So it's great to have you on the pod. Welcome, Saskia.
Thank you so much for having me. It's a real pleasure to be here.
You're currently the chief behavioral scientist at Our Future Health. And we've had Andy Rodham, the CEO of Our Future Health, on the pod before. 5 million people, tons of exciting research opportunities. Listeners should go check out that episode as well. But I guess no one is born as the chief behavioral scientist at Our Future Health. Tell us a little bit about how you got into this field and I guess a little bit about what your passions are.
So I really started off as a psychologist. So my undergraduate degree at Birmingham was psychology. And to be honest, I'd actually originally wanted to study English literature. And it was my granny said that wasn't vocational enough. And actually there are quite a lot of similarities between psychology and English literature because you're studying people and characters and so on. Anyway, it turned out to be the right decision. And while I was at uni, I really got into a number of different areas. There were a few things that sort of really, really grabbed me. One of the first things I remember really striking me was the sort of biopsychosocial model of health and well-being, mid-90s. I was really interested in people, in the idea of being helping people through sort of psychology, through understanding the mind and behavior. But there was already that sort of inkling that I was interested in, like the sort of ways that biology and society, social factors, all of these different factors are sort of in the mix, influencing people mentally and physically.
So that's the biopsychosocial, is our biology, our psychology, and our kind of social environs or whatever combined to, do they add up to like our health or well-being, or like, how would you describe that?
All of that, exactly. So both, I mean, I was obviously studying it at the time in terms of mental health and psychology and the mind, but obviously exactly the same applies to physical health and the rest of the body. So then there was something, there were a few other things that sort of really struck me at the time. Then the other thing was I really felt through what I was learning that if you intervened with someone by the time they were in their 30s or 40s, often it was too late. And at the time I was thinking about mental health and social issues and so on. And so I really started getting interested in the idea of early intervention at that time. And also that actually led me all the way back to childhood. And I decided I wanted to help children and work with children. And so the very first job I took as after university was as an assistant child psychologist, actually at Rotherham District General Hospital. And I was really into the work. But one thing that I sort of felt while I was there was I wanted to move to London.
The bright lights, the big city.
I was totally drawn to London. And so I took a sort of internship, sort of a voluntary position, working at the SGDP, the Social Genetic and Developmental Psychiatry Centre at King's, with Robert Plowman. And that was just for a few months, really, working sort of in the office on a project called Genesis, which was looking at depression and anxiety and genetic and environmental influences of that. But while I was there, Robert had set up the Twins Early Development Study, TEDS. And Jane Wardle at UCL was collaborating with him on that project. And she had this research assistant job, which was basically going around and feeding these 4 to 5 year old twins. They're now like grown-ups with their own children, which makes me feel very old. But I would go around the country feeding these 4 year old twins biscuits whilst they, I put them down a video of Pingu.
How to win friends and influence people.
Right? I mean, these children were very happy. They had these big plates of biscuits. We sat them down in front of Pingu. This was, they were like, awesome, research is great. So we weighed the kids, we weighed the parents. And what we were looking at was children's eating behaviours, again, genetic and environmental influences on children's eating behaviours. In this point, and so we also weighed the biscuits before and after we gave them to the kids.
I was gonna say it feels a bit unfair. I feel if someone was gonna like give me a massive curry and then weigh me, I'd feel like I'd been sort of like outdone by, but deduct the weight of the biscuits.
We didn't weigh the children before and after the biscuits, just the thing I haven't said though, obviously what happened was I'd taken the research job to work with kids, but in doing so my boss at Rotherham wrote my reference and said, I think Saskia is going to be better at research than she was at clinical. And it wasn't because I'd done anything sort of particularly wrong. It was just that I was sort of frustrated a little bit with just applying stuff that we already knew or that was already known. And she was absolutely right. I was much more suited to research where I was sort of could have my, I was just interested to understand more about why people are the way they are.
Once you had made that move into research, you mentioned trying to unpick what makes people the way that they are. How do you, I guess, break that question apart a bit and pick a piece of it to work on? Because it's such a huge question.
Yeah. Well, I mean, with this particular project at the time, it was very specifically, you know, what makes people eat the way they do? And in order to answer that question, we'd, you know, gone in with these four-year-old twins. We were looking at their eating behavior and developed and administered the children's eating behavior questionnaire. Then we also took samples from them for DNA extraction, and we looked at their genetic makeup, and we looked at a gene called the FTO, which was looking like it was going to be associated at that time with obesity. What we actually showed at that time was we were one of the first groups, and I love the graph that we have in the paper of this. We showed that the kids with the high risk version of the FTO gene variants ate much more of the biscuits than those with the lower risk version. And so it was really showing that, you know, it was one of the early studies that showed that behavior itself is influenced by genetics. And of course, because that's influencing, it's because the genes are influencing behavior, and it's partly that's influencing obesity, which then has, you know, which then has both physical and social implications. So I really loved that work. And what I was doing was looking at genetic and environmental influences on behavior itself. It was that sort of discovery research, looking at underlying causes.
So that's fascinating. So I guess people's first instinct might be to think like, how do our genes affect our weight? Would be about, well, actually our bodies will respond in different ways to eating the same food because of the genetic difference. But actually your point is it's not just, well, we're not saying whether it is or it isn't the way that the body responds, but actually that the gene can drive behavior, which then has the impact on the body.
Exactly. And it makes sense, right? Because we're biological beings and the brain is part of the body and we're all different. We know that we're all different. Anyone with more than one child can see that their children are born different, you know, psychologically, emotionally, behaviorally, their tendencies, their likes, their dislikes. I think it always comes as a surprise to people. And I think people worry about it because it sort of seems to be a threat to sort of free will. But as long as you sort of buy into the idea of the science of DNA and genetics and inheritance and the fact that we're biological as well as social beings, it shouldn't really be that threatening or that surprising.
Well, there was that great Disney Pixar film that came out over Christmas called Soul. And I listened to an interview with the director who had said, basically exactly what you'd said. After he'd had two or three kids, he realized that they had just emerged into the world as the people that they were. And, you know, they could try and help as parents to kind of guide them in this world, but it's not like as parents, they were going to fundamentally reshape who these children were. And hence this idea of the great before, where, you know, they get assigned their badges or whatever that gives them the personalities they have.
Exactly. And I mentioned I sort of started out working with Robert Plomin and continued collaborating with him through this project, through the TEDS project, and sort of carried on sort of talking with him over the years. And one of the things I always remember Robert saying really early on, he said, you know, if you only ever look at the biological or the genetic, or you only ever look at the social, you're only ever going to get half the picture. And that sort of has always sort of stayed with me. I just always have felt like, you know, we are social beings. The way you talk to people, the way you help people through talking therapies or through support and so on is all incredibly helpful. And that's why my sort of first passion was psychology. But at the same time, we're just not doing ourselves any favors if we ignore the fact that biology and genetics and what you're born with there has an impact on who you become physically and mentally. Doesn't mean it's deterministic, doesn't mean that you can't shape how you are going to be, doesn't mean that as a parent that you have no control at all. It doesn't mean that it doesn't matter what you do. Of course it matters what you do as a parent, but I think it's actually quite helpful as a parent also to sort of take a step back and go, you know, and sort of allow them to become who they're going to be while supporting them through it. So then what happened in my career was actually that then, as I mentioned, I was working with Jane Wardle, who was a very important sort of mentor throughout my life. And she got a PhD grant from Cancer Research UK. And this was looking at the potential impact that genetic testing for lung cancer risk might have on the behavior of smokers, on their ability to quit smoking. Now, this was in 1999, and I started my PhD in 2000. And if you think about what was going on, so I was doing my PhD between 2000 and 2005. And in that time, there was an awful lot going on in the world of genetics. So when I started my PhD, the Human Genome Project had not been completed. The first human genome sequence had not been completed. Obviously, as you know, 2001, HapMap hadn't been published. The first GWAS was published towards the end of my PhD. So it was an extraordinarily exciting time to be a PhD student. And what that meant, though, for me was that up till then I'd been looking at the genetics of behaviour. And of course, this was the moment where I switched to looking at the behavioral impact of genetic information. So I moved from genetics of behavior to the behavioral impact of genetic information. And that's really what then sort of set me on the trajectory for the next 20 years of my career.
And so the behavioral impact of genetic information, that's studying how people react when they get genetic information. Is it whether that's kind of 23andMe or Ancestry.com type consumer thing, or a test in a hospital, or I guess a whole range of?
Yeah, and again, just remembering that when I was doing my PhD at that time, there was hardly any of those companies existed. You know, there were no polygenic risk scores or genetic risk scores. There were no genome-wide association studies. None of that had started yet. There was the SNPs didn't exist. The common genetic variants didn't exist. It was the really early days still of genetics and genetic testing. So I started getting more involved in the world of that sort of genetic testing. And there was obviously the whole world of Huntington's disease genetic testing and breast cancer genetic testing. And my instinct though was to definitely stay in this world of the role of genetics in common complex diseases and traits. And so I felt like there was a role for me as a psychologist and as a health psychologist in this space of trying to understand ultimately what is the utility, the usefulness of genetic information when it's in the context of these common diseases like behavior-related cancers or heart disease and so on. So I was interested in this idea that genetic information had a role to play in helping us potentially helping in areas that we're really struggling with, like, you know, preventing and treating these common complex diseases and traits. And ultimately, what I really wanted to do in my research was do the studies where you can, you know, do experimental studies of sort of randomly assigning to people to one condition or another, or looking at what happens when you do give genetic information to people and you assess the outcomes. You assess, well, everyone worries, like, will it falsely reassure people if it's low risk? Will it really upset people if it's high risk? Will people misunderstand it? Will people suddenly change their lifestyle behaviors? Will they do other things to, like, dramatically reduce their risk? What will be the behavioral and the psychological impact of all this? And I was like, well, you know, we can ask those questions, but we can also do the empirical research to answer them. And one of the things that also that I came to realize, though, is that in order to get to the point of being able to answer those questions, you've actually got to do a really good job of communicating the information in the first place. So then as a psychologist, and I started getting interested also in everything that came but comes before that, sort of upstream of sort of giving somebody the results and looking at the impact. So how do you support informed decision making at the beginning? How do you help people make informed choices? How do you develop the materials and the information? What's the right level of support for people to have at that point? Once they've decided they do want this information, how do you communicate it? What's the right format? How do you present it visually, in written format? What's the right support? And then after you've given the result, what's the right support afterwards? So as a psychologist, a health psychologist and a behavioral scientist, I kind of started seeing that we had a role to play in my discipline, applying psychology to genomics across the entire sort of pathway.
Sure. And I guess in human terms, there was, I'm not sure if it's fair to say, an amount of controversy around, for example, Angelina Jolie having a genetic test that highlighted that she had the BRCA variant that increased her risk of breast cancer and having preventative surgery in response to that. Are there any other kind of human stories that illustrate either the risks we're trying to avoid or the benefits that we're trying to capture through doing this better?
Yes. So I think, that there are probably lots of good examples from the sort of clinical genetics world. So, obviously, as you fully know, at the 100,000 Genomes Project, there's a huge role for genetics in, helping diagnose rare diseases, treating cancers and so on. I think in the work that I've done, I spent some time in the States, in America, first of all in Washington, D.C. at the NIH, and then I moved to the Icahn School of Medicine at Mount Sinai in New York. And that was at a time when Mount Sinai had just set up a biobank, BioMe, and also the first people outside of the clinical context were starting to have their genome sequenced. So in 2007, you may remember Craig Venter had his genome sequenced. 2008, James Watson, 2008, also George Church and his personal genome project, the 10 people. So what we could see was going on, and we were really interested in setting up our own sort of genome sequencing capacity at Mount Sinai. So we could see that some people were starting to have their genome sequenced. They're a pretty homogeneous bunch.
A bunch of middle-aged bloke scientists.
Right. And so my colleagues and I were like, well, we think that we could probably, maybe some other people should be having their genome sequence. And one of the things, one of the interesting...
Wow, you were radical thinkers, huh?
Well, exactly. And it was interesting because what had happened with the Personal Genome Project was they said it's really concerning, that it's really difficult to understand genetics and genomics and whole genome sequencing. And so the solution to that would be to make sure that we take people through this really, really rigorous genetics exam, basically a test, before we allow them to have their whole genome sequence. And hence you ended up with this select bunch of people, the first 10 people through that project having their genome sequence. I also know a lot of geneticists who failed that exam more than once.
But it's a brilliantly kind of, this is maybe an unfair comment, but it's a brilliantly kind of Victorian patrician attitude, isn't it? Sort of, I do a lot of hiking in Scotland, and on the island of Skye, there are these mountains called the Black Coolin, and the first Victorian guidebooks that talk about the Black Coolin say women and the infirm of mind should not visit the Black Coolin because it would upset them too much. The mountains are too dramatic.
Wow. Okay. Well, quite. In response to this, we said, well, okay, an alternative approach is that we develop ways of supporting people's understanding that they do understand, and that is appropriate for different groups. And so Mount Sinai is a hospital on the Upper East Side of Manhattan, and we served a really diverse patient population there. So to the south of the hospital, it's the Upper East Side. It's very white, very affluent, one of the richest parts of America. And to the north of the hospital is East Harlem, very diverse, but a lot of Hispanic and African American people, a lot of poverty. And we really wanted to make it possible to do genome sequencing for a much more diverse group of people. And so we did a number of things at the time. You know, we developed an animated video. We spent a lot of time, we spent a year like doing focus groups and working really closely with local communities and getting a lot of co-design in from people in the community surrounding Mount Sinai to develop these educational resources. And this video is still on YouTube today as an sort of educational resource. And we put in place a sort of consent process that we felt was more sort of supportive of people from a range of backgrounds. And then we did the HealthSeek project and opened that up to people at the hospital, around the hospital and so on. Just on that point, actually, we ended up not getting as diverse an audience of participants as we would have liked, because we'd gone out to East Harlem to the sort of community centers where they serve the really sort of lower income groups. And actually the doctors in that area said they couldn't offer it. They couldn't really collaborate with us on this because their patients were underinsured and uninsured. And if anything was found through the genome sequencing, then they wouldn't be able to afford the follow-on, you know, tests and investigations that would be needed. And that was really important for us. I think that was a real sort of, that was one of the first sort of big learning moments, I think, for us as a team, and was made me think a lot about what we're doing with this kind of technology, and how important, you know, the technology is one thing, how you deliver it is one thing, but you cannot do it. You just can't think about it in a vacuum. You've got to think about it in the wider context of the society, the community, the way that people are living and what they have access to and what support you give people afterwards.
It's so important. And our tagline at Genomics England is making the benefits of genomic healthcare available to everyone. And that word everyone is really important. I think we take for granted as an organization in the UK that a huge chunk of that word everyone is delivered by an equitable health system, which is free at the point of care for everyone, right? And yeah, we almost forget that the context is so different in different countries, different communities, different societies and so on.
So that's exactly what happened with one of our people who did take part in the project. He was a young guy in the HealthSeek project. He was a young guy in his 20s. He was actually, you know, reasonably educated and affluent and so on. But he, through the project, we told him that we had found a rare variant in the SCN5A gene, so associated with Brugada syndrome, which is a sudden cardiac death condition. He got this result, and as you can imagine, he was actually quite concerned about it. And exactly that, in the States, once something goes into your medical records, then it's there for good. So he really did not want, you know, Brugada syndrome sort of on his medical records. So there was concern around that initially. Anyway, that sort of got resolved, and we were able to, and he sort of did have investigations, he did have follow-on tests and so on. And after several months, it looked like everything was, you know, physiologically, he was fine and okay. So we'd measured, you know, we'd measured his all of our participants' psychological well-being and distress and anxiety and so on before, immediately after, and then 6 months after we'd given them their results. And so we knew, we could see a sort of big peak, we could see that he got distressed immediately after he got this result, but that it had really sort of come down a lot over the months. But what also happened for him is that in that same results appointment, he was informed that he was also APOE E4E4. And what that means is that he has a very significantly increased risk of Alzheimer's disease as well. And so in his words, when we interviewed him at 6 months, he'd said, like, I didn't really even hear the Alzheimer's result because I was so focused on the sudden cardiac death result. But over time, as he sort of dealt with the latter, he started thinking more and more about the former. So, and then a footnote to that is that at the time that the variant in the gene associated with sudden cardiac death had been labelled as, I think, likely pathogenic and so returned and to him. And actually later, all of those, that sort of category of conditions, it turned out that as the research accumulated over time, actually that variant was sort of downgraded. And if we did the research today, we would never have returned that result to him.
Wow, that's fascinating, because it's It's a hot topic at the moment around people who have had a genetic or genomic test historically that may not have benefited from all of the advances in the knowledge base since then, that we may have missed something or like missed a diagnosis and so on. And it's interesting actually to see some models popping up in the States, which are subscription models for consumer, like direct to consumer. So not just pay us $1,000 and get your genome sequenced, but pay us $1,000 and then pay us $100 a year and we'll reanalyze your genome every year and you'll get the latest test advances and so on. It's really interesting, this idea of actually something being flagged as a big risk or a big deal because of a limited knowledge base, that then as the knowledge base grows, it actually goes down. So you can see, I'm almost picturing one of those sort of Google Trends type sort of charts, that things can kind of go up or down in significance as that knowledge base grows.
So there's so many implications of that, obviously. I mean, you know, for us, that was clearly, again, there was a lot to learn from having gone through that sort of process and that research project. And you know, it certainly really brings to the fore exactly what you're saying, that you know, we have to be so mindful in genomics and genetics that things are going to continue changing over time. The science is going to continue developing, what we understand about the conditions will continue developing. And how we deal with that, how we communicate that to people when they're making decisions about having genome sequencing or genomic sequencing and testing done, how we support them over time, whether and how we go back to them over time and so on. All of these are really, really important questions that we have to address as we start to, you know, work out how to integrate genomic sequencing more and more into our healthcare systems. The other thing about it, as you were saying, that there's the sort of notion that genome sequencing is sometimes sort of as like a test, but actually it's more of a resource, right? It's a resource, not a test. If you sequence someone's genome, you don't automatically get a load of results out at the other end. It doesn't sort of suddenly spew out like lots of high risk, low risk results. You get a series of A, C's, G's and T's. That's what happens when you sequence someone's genome. And then you go in and you look for things that you know from the literature, and either you're looking for it because you know this person has something and you're trying to find something in their DNA that will help you understand it, or in the case of sort of more sort of predictive, preventive sort of models, you're going in looking for things like whether it's rare variants like in BRCA genes or these sort of new sort of polygenic risk scores, these more common genetic variants. You're looking for things that might increase and influence their risk in the future. But all of that tells you that, you know, you can sequence someone's genome. You can sequence someone's genome at birth. You don't have to look for those. You don't have to go in and look for all these things. You have to make a decision, first of all, whether you're going to offer the sequencing or not. You have to support the individual as much as you can to make the choice and their family as to whether they want to do it or not. And then you have to make a choice about what you're going to go in and look for. So you have to make that decision in that moment. And over time, you have to make the call as to whether you are going to go back and either update those same results or exactly as you've just said, that emerging model that you're seeing coming out of the States of, you know, exactly that, recognizing that it's a resource that's sitting there that you can sort of look at over time. And that has, you know, really significant implications for how you deliver this kind of sequencing genomic information in healthcare and in society.
It's an incredibly rich tapestry, isn't it? If I think about some of the themes that we've talked about just in this conversation so far, right? There's, you just mentioned this question of, in a given context, do you sequence someone's DNA? If so, what do you go in and look for? Once you've found something, how do you then communicate that to the person in a way that they can understand? And we're talking about the probabilities of probabilities and statistics and so on, which the human brain doesn't necessarily intuitively grasp. And then there's this extra dimension of, while the DNA is broadly static over time, our understanding of it is dynamic over time. And then if we really want to blow our minds, actually this whole genomic picture is only one lens. Actually, there's the whole psychological perspective on that person. There's the whole social context that they live in. How can we possibly try and draw all of those elements together at scale in a way that allows us to give the best care to an individual human being?
It's really hard, right?
Have you got any magic answers?
There are no magic answers, but I think we do, you know, we talk about this a lot, and that, you know, we, there are some things that make genetics and genomics special. You know, you do share it with your, you share your DNA with your family members. It is something that you can measure at birth that does, you know, there is information in there that will eventually, you know, probably in the quite near future, be able to tell you, give you your healthcare provider, your information about your future heart disease risk and that kind of thing. So there are some things about it that are special, and there are some things about it that's not. We use all sorts of risk factors in assessing whether somebody should go on a statin, because their estimated lifetime risk or 10-year risk of having a heart attack is over 10%. And that's based on all sorts of different factors, you know, whether you smoke, your weight, your age, your gender, your cholesterol, so you're already drawing, and that's all going into something like, you know, Q-Risk 3 or another sort of algorithm. And at the end of that, you get a number. Your risk of having a heart attack in the next 10 years is 12%. And at that point, your GP says, it's over 10. It's over 10%. And therefore, we're going to now have a conversation about you changing your lifestyle and whether you want to start a statin or not. And so in that model, you can see you're drawing on biological factors, you're drawing on things you've measured in the blood, you're drawing on things that the patient can't change, like their age, and you're drawing on things like they're doing, like smoking, and their BMI that's influenced by their eating and their exercise and so on. And you're already drawing on a lot of different factors there. So the question is, you know, is it that big a deal to pull in the DNA information as well? So the answer is a bit of both. You know, it's probably, if we're confident that this is adding useful information to make the risk prediction more accurate, why wouldn't you use it? Why would you decide this is the one thing you're not going to incorporate? Are you going to do it in a sort of irresponsible kind of way? No, you're going to need to do things like, you know, make sure that the GP understands enough to be able to answer the patient's questions. You're going to need to make sure that the patient understands enough that they're not going to throw their hands up in horror and say, it's in my DNA, this is terrifying. You know, you need to make sure it's sort of a big deal and it isn't.
Well, I guess there's a parallel maybe to if all of us had to pass an exam explaining how a telly worked before we could watch Netflix, you know, that company would go out of business pretty quickly, right? And I think the interesting thing about the kind of risk scores that you mentioned, like Q-Risk and so on about heart attacks, is actually a lot of that complexity is under the surface, kind of like the swan, right? There's all this paddling that's happening under the surface. What do we actually need to discuss with the patient is the sort of white birdie bit, right? It's like the bit that you can see. We don't need to worry about what's happening under the water. as long as there is enough kind of, I guess, trustworthiness in the system for people to feel confident that it's not being abused or anything, and for it to be transparent and auditable. If people have any concerns about what's happening under the surface, they should be able to, like, I'm really stretching the metaphor here, put on a mask and kind of have a look at the feet pedaling, right? But most people probably don't care what's happening under the surface, just like they don't care how their TV works. I have no idea how a TV works, but, you know.
No, but I think if your GP said to you your BMI is 32, then you would be well within your rights to say, what does the number 32 mean in this context? And you would expect your GP to be able to answer that question sensibly. Yeah. And the same with a number for cholesterol and blood pressure and so on. And this is why, as a psychologist and behavioral scientist, I sort of, you know, initially and ultimately, I am really interested in genomics, because I think I'm hoping that we can, you know, leverage genomics to maximize the benefits, minimize the harms, and now harness this to help people going forwards physically and mentally more and more. But in the meantime, to get to that point, there are lots of things that we have to do along the way in terms of, you know, high communication and education and communication about risk and communication about uncertainty and making available information about genomics in a way that people do understand. And if people don't want very much information, that's fine. But you need to be able to deliver it in a way that you can be confident enough that they're giving valid consent, or that they aren't going to turn around in a few weeks or months or years time and go, well, that wasn't what I signed up for. So it's not a straightforward thing to any, none of this is, as you all know, it's not straightforward to talk to people about genomics. And I think that's why sort of psychology, behavioral science has a role to play throughout the whole sort of pathway, if you like.
Well, you're contributing to a better understanding of genomics by having this conversation. So thank you. You mentioned something there, which is very much on my mind at the moment, which is sequencing newborns. And this is something that's been mentioned by the Secretary of State a few times. We've done a bunch of public dialogue work around that. And it's maybe worth just giving some context about what that would mean in the short term, which is that at the moment we do this heel prick test when a kid is born, and it tests for 9 specific things from the drop of blood. And it's yes or no to 9 things. And the basic idea in the short term is to say, actually, instead of testing for 9 things, we could test for 200 or 300 things by sequencing the newborn's blood. And we would only look for things that affected children early in childhood and that were concretely identifiable, that were strongly heritable, i.e. if we see this change in the DNA, we will see this effect in the body, and that we can do something about, that are sort of actionable. So in that sense, it's a broader test for a newborn. But then, as you say, it also opens up a lot of other interesting questions about, once we have that information, what else could we use it for if that person chose to, if the health system thought it was a good idea, and if. From a behavioral science point of view, how can we start to unpack these complex questions of, if our DNA is with us for life, what should we look for? What should we communicate? And how should we think about acting on that information over the course of, let's say, the 80 or 90 years of someone's life?
And I think there's obviously so many ethical, especially by the time you go all the way to newborns, there's obviously so many ethical as well as practical challenges in that area, or things to consider. But I do think that we do need to have a serious conversation, a discussion and debate about how early we should go. Because at the moment we do things like, you know, we offer health checks to people over the age of 40, because that's when people start showing symptoms. Well, if your DNA was there at 18 and over the next 10, 20 years, your arteries were getting more and more clogged up, or your cholesterol levels were getting higher and higher, whatever it is, that then in your 30s, late 30s, early 40s, maybe your 50s, you then sort of present with high cholesterol, or even maybe have a heart attack, and that's the first indication there is that this has been going on. Why wouldn't we as a society seriously start debating the earliest appropriate age where we should start using genomics for not only treatment and diagnosis, but also prevention and earlier, and facilitating earlier detection? Now, there are good reasons why we might decide not to, and there are good reasons to discuss exactly what the right age should be for what types of things. You know, maybe it's 18 for some, maybe it's childhood for others, maybe it's 30 for others even. But these are all questions that, you know, A, we should be having that debate, and B, from my perspective as a psychologist and behavioral scientist, what's just really, really important is that as we start testing, rolling these things out, we just really do make sure that we're collecting the data on how people are thinking and feeling about what is happening with them, you know, that we are collecting the data on whether they're making informed decisions, that we are collecting data on what they feel the right amount of information is that they need to give valid consent, that when we do give them results about themselves or their child, that we ask them, you know, we ask them qualitatively and quantitatively how it impacted them, that we measure the impact in their healthcare records so we can see what's happening clinically, behaviorally, psychologically, socially. I think the important thing to me is that we do that research. You collect good quality data, both self-reported, psychological, behavioral, as well as clinical, and the kinds of things you can pick up in the health records. Then we can learn from that, and we can make better decisions as a society and as a healthcare system going forwards. So I think my main answer to that is, you know, get the data, the behavioral and psychological data, as well as all the other types of data, and make use of that to inform decisions going forwards.
I love the point you made earlier, which is we shouldn't just be asking these questions. We should be setting up experiments to answer them. And I think that's exactly right. You know, we can ask the questions, we can debate it in the pub until, you know, we're blue in the face, but let's actually get the data. Let's do the work.
And I think you asked the question about, you know, the role of behavioral science and psychology in the space. It's getting the data, and then it's also doing those really rigorous experiments, doing the A-B testing, working out what does and doesn't work in terms of the communication, in terms of the support, in terms of testing out what works for who.
Excellent. And you said earlier, we think we need to be having this conversation, including people in the dialogue. One of the aspirations around this whole podcast series is to try and bring some of that conversation into the public domain and so on. If you were going to pick either a couple of topics or a couple of people who you think we should be giving airtime to, what would either the topics or the people be that you think we should highlight?
I think one of the big topics that's coming is, I've mentioned it a few times in passing, is polygenic risk scores. People generally are quite aware of things like the BRCA, BRCA1 and 2 genes, of breast and ovarian cancer, through really high publicity cases like Angelina Jolie. So I think people generally have a pretty good sense of the sort of rare variants that have a big impact, a relatively big impact on disease risk. I think what we haven't really begun yet is that public debate about these common genetic variants that individually only impact disease risk or reduce disease risk or impact well-being by very small amounts. But once you combine dozens, hundreds, thousands, or even millions of them, you start to be able to see people at the top end of the risk scores that might actually really benefit from intervention. I think starting that public dialogue about rare versus common DNA variants and how both can individually and combined impact disease risk and well-being, I think, is going to be really important in the coming years. I think what would be really awesome is if we could not only harness genomics in a way that doesn't increase inequalities in health, maybe there's even things that we could do to harness genomics that could actually help to reduce the disparities in health. That would be a real challenge.
Fantastic. Well, that is an inspirational note to wrap up a wide-ranging conversation. Saskia, thank you so much for your time today and for coming on the pod.
Thank you so much for having me. It's been a real pleasure. I've listened to loads and loads of your other podcast interviews, and I'm absolutely thrilled to have now done one myself with you. So it's been really lovely. Thank you.
Well, that's all for this episode. Thanks for listening to this discussion about the G word and for joining us on this journey to highlight and debate the implications of genomics as it comes to the mainstream of healthcare and society. Remember to subscribe to the G word on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen. If you have views on these topics, if you have a suggestion for someone we should interview, then do write to us at podcast@genomicsengland.co.uk. And do remember, if you've enjoyed listening, that giving us a 5-star review really helps other people find out about the series, and appreciate it very much. See you on the next episode of The G Word.